letting me know what he was doing.
Fuel flow is 200. Oil pressure is indicating. EGT rising.
So was my blood pressure. He was actually going to take me up in the jet.
770 peak. Engine instruments look good. Hydraulics look good. Caution lights are out. Crossover is good.
He paused. His helmet turned a little as if waiting for a response. There's this weird thing in flying that makes it almost like a religion. Pilots do call and response as a liturgy of our own. My engine instruments are good. Hydraulics check good. Caution lights are out.
Clear left.
I checked again. Clear.
Okay. Let's divert air to number one. Hands clear.
Parker lifted his hands over his head. My hands are clear. Outside, the ground crew ran to switch the hose to the number two engine. Again, I had to marvel at the difference between Parker the teacher and Parker the asshole. His voice through all of this was calm and patient.
Ready to start, number one?
Ready. My voice, on the other hand, might have cracked a little. It was all I could do not to cackle with glee as the aircraft came alive beneath us. We went through the same checks for the number one engine, and by the end of it, I had almost matched the calmness of Parker's voice.
Throttle gate is engaged. Okay. Let's disconnect air.
He lifted his hands over his head.
Hands clear?
My hands are clear. They were clear of all instruments and, somewhat remarkably, not shaking. All of my nerves seemed to be vibrating, but it didn't show in my hands. Jets are infinitely easier than crowds and much, much more alluring. When the ground crew pulled the hose away from the engine, Parker resumed his litany.
Battery switch checks out. Good start.
We went through the pre-taxi checks and nav checks with the same call and response. Then we got to...
Time to pull the canopy and seat pins.
Canopy and seat pins pulled? The bright orange plastic came out easily. I lifted them both over my head to demonstrate that I'd done it before stowing them in the pocket by my left knee.
Chalk's clear.
Outside, the crew followed his hand signals. We began to taxi. A plane on the ground is an ungainly thing. It jostled me against my shoulder straps, but I followed along with Parker as we went through the rest of the nav and comm checklists during taxi.
Arms clear.
He lowered the canopies and cut off the breeze from the outside. My God. Even in the rear seat, the plane had such a wide field of vision. What must it have been like in front? The tower came over our radio.
Talon 1-1 Tower, you are cleared for takeoff.
Parker's head turned a little as if he could look over his shoulder to see me.
You ready?
Confirmed ready. He nodded and replied to the tower.
Talon 1-1, cleared for takeoff.
Parker brought the jet up to full military power and lit the afterburner. The jet jolted like someone had kicked me in the pants. He released the brakes and popped the burners. The engine whine rose in pitch as the jet rolled forward, forcing me back into my seat. It wasn't like a prop plane, where the force is almost gentle. This thundered through me, dragging my back into the seat. She lifted off the runway so smoothly I almost clapped as the ground fell away. But this was a training flight, not a tourist ride, so my delight stayed inside. I watched the gauges and the world outside. It was like the air had become liquid and flowed around us. How can you feel heavy and light at the same time? The G-force of takeoff pressed me into my seat, but the air held me up. God, this was a beautiful plane. My love for it probably broke all the rules about worshiping graven images.
York.
Parker banked to the south and pressed me further into my seat. Sir? He wasn't going to offer to let me take the stick, was he? Not yet.
I have a problem, and I need a favor.
Come again?
You heard me.
The asshole Parker returned for a moment, and then he sighed. There's an intimacy to the sound of another pilot in your ear.
Look. Look. You and Malouf are the only two who know about the thing with my leg.
I... Where was this going? I haven't told anyone.
I know.
He sighed again.
Thank you.
What? Everything about this conversation confused me. He couldn't have said this on the ground? For that matter, why hadn't Malouf reported him? May I ask what's going on? Above the canopy, the clouds sank toward us, changing from a featureless expanse of silver gray to crenellations of cotton. Parker took us up into them, and the wisps brushed past, feathering away as we ripped through. The jet punched out of the upper level of clouds into blue sky. God! It was not profanity. It had been so long since I had seen clear blue. It ached, that blue. The unobscured sun flared across the clouds and brought tears to my eyes, even with my visor.
Yeah.
Parker sighed again.
This is amazing, but space. I need to see a doctor. My leg goes pins and needles and then randomly just stops working. They'll ground me if they even suspect something is wrong.
So go to a doctor who's not a flight surgeon. Parker gave the bitterest laugh I'd heard from him.
You think I haven't tried? I'm the first man into space. I can't go anywhere without reporters following me. I can't sneeze. I can't play ball with my sons. I can't even visit my...
He stopped talking, leaving only the hiss of oxygen, the sound of my own breathing, and the rush of air around us. Can't visit your...
Can't visit my doctor.
Pretty sure that hadn't been what he was going to say.
If I certify you on the T-38, will you let me use the flights to mask my visits to a doctor?
I asked questions to buy time. How will that work exactly? I mean, you're not going to let me go up on my own.
No, but there's a clinic. We land near it, I go in, I come back out, we keep flying.
Just the T-38? You're not offering me a seat on a rocket?
Can't.
His helmet turned as if he wanted to look back at me.
I get some say in that, but not the final word. If I did, gotta be honest, there wouldn't be any women in the program at all. Not yet.
You know I've logged more flight hours than you, right?
Yes. And I know about the Messerschmitts and the target practice and all the other things you WASP did. None of that matches what a test pilot does, and it sure as hell doesn't match what we do up there.
Well, we can't know that, can we? Besides, how hard can it be if you can do it with a bum leg? He put the plane into a roll as if that proved some sort of point. I laughed, giggled, really. Sorry, wait, I wasn't laughing at you. It's just, the plane is beautiful.
She really is.
He leveled the T-38 out and left us nearly floating in our seats.
So, will you do it?
You still hate me?
Yep.
He sighed again, which was such an odd sound coming from him. It was as if he had to let his ego leak out before he could keep talking.
But I acknowledge that you will keep your word and are principled.
And you aren't worried that those principles will lead me to report you?
I am.
The problem is that you're asking me to risk lives and jeopardize the program.
I've kept myself off crew lists, but there's a difference between deferring missions and being grounded.
And now they want you to go to the moon. The thing that was tempting about his proposition wasn't the T-38. It was the chance to finally be in his good graces, even if he resented me for it. I don't know. Maybe before I'd been in the program, I would have been able to take him up on the deal. But now? Now I knew exactly how fit you had to be as an astronaut. To say nothing of what would happen if I got caught colluding. I won't tell anyone, but... I'm sorry. I can't help you hide it. The air hissed past in our silence.
Well, you're honest. I'll give you that. Okay.
Parker's head dipped forward and then lifted.
I know about the Milltown.
35. Hurricane data sought.
Three UN planes detailed for research work. Paris, November 3rd, 1957. Three United Nations planes will be detailed for special hurricane research work next summer and fall, officials said today. The United States Air Force will supply the United Nations with two B-50 Superforts and a B-47 Stratojet for the project. They will fly the Atlantic, Caribbean, and the Gulf of Mexico as part of an ongoing effort to understand how weather patterns have shifted since the meteor strike in 1952.
How do you tell your husband that you're being blackmailed? Over dinner? Say, sweetie, a funny thing happened to me today, pass the salad? Maybe in bed, while distracting him with sex. Or you could just blurt it out while brushing your teeth. Parker's trying to blackmail me. Nathaniel pulled the floss out of his mouth and turned.
What?
He knows about the Milltown and wants my help with something.
What?
Same word, totally different meaning. His hands were clenched so tightly around the floss that it cut into the sides of his fingers, turning them dead white. I swallowed, and the minty freshness made my stomach turn over in sour knots. I drew a full breath that burned cold. The knot of anxiety in my chest would have sent me reaching for a Milltown, but not now. Damn, Parker. You can't tell anyone. This is why I hadn't told him at work. If I had, he would have stormed into Clemens's office and made demands about Parker's attempts at blackmail.
Clemens has to know.
The tips of his fingers past the floss had begun to go purple. Setting my toothbrush in the holder, I sighed. Let's sit down. Nathaniel looked down and blinked at the floss. He uncurled it, flexing his fingers, and dropped it into the waste bin.
Okay.
By the time we got to the sofa, trembles shook my arms and sweat coated my back. I swallowed and stared at my hands, which I held in a relaxed and ladylike posture on my lap. Mama would be so proud. If you tell anyone, then Clemens will know about the Milltown and my anxiety and the vomiting. And then what will he think? That I'm fit to go into space? That I'm even fit for the program? He already thinks I'm a publicity stunt.
Who told you that?
The sofa creaked as he leaned forward.
Parker.
I nodded. Nathaniel pushed himself off the sofa and paced to the Murphy bed and back. He stopped in front of the coffee table, legs spread, and hands on his hips.
Tell me what happened.
Promise me that you won't tell anyone. Tendons jumped under the skin on the backs of my hands, but I didn't clench them into fists or do anything. His body stayed rigidly still, but he turned to stare out the window at the lights of Kansas.
I can promise you that I will talk with you before doing anything. I can't promise to do nothing, because that is a promise I won't keep.
I rubbed my thumb on one of the muscles that kept twitching. Why I bothered, I don't know, since my entire body was trembling with stress. He's been having trouble with his left leg. Pins and needles, he says. A couple of months ago, I caught him in the stairwell and he couldn't stand. Asked me not to tell. Later, it looked like it had gone away, so I thought it was temporary. And it had felt safer to keep waiting for someone else to see his symptoms. I could chalk my silence up to prudence or compassion, but it had been largely fear. Drawing another breath, I told Nathaniel about the flight, and the request, and then the demand. He took me with him to the clinic. I think he didn't want me out of his sight.
Into the examining room?
Nathaniel's voice cracked. No, no. Just the lobby. There had been a phone at the nurse's station, and I'd nearly called Nathaniel from there. Thank God I hadn't. When Parker came out, he was green, and he stopped in the bathroom to throw up. The problem with small clinics is that the walls are thin. I am all too familiar with the sound of retching. After another 5 minutes, he came out. He was pale, but not green, and he put his aviators on. I had some guesses about why he was wearing sunglasses inside. My eyes always got red after a bout of vomiting. Nathaniel grunted.
So the news is bad. Did he tell you what?
I shook my head. I didn't ask. I let him pretend that everything was fine.
That was kinder than he deserved.
I shook my head. I just didn't want to feel sorry for him.
Anything else?
He let me have the controls of the T-38 on the way back. I guess it was a reward or something. My fingers had gone to ice. How could I be sweating and cold at the same time? So, that's it. Back at the IAC, it was like nothing had happened. Nathaniel grunted again and turned back to pacing. He's tall, my husband, and our apartment doesn't give him a lot of ground to cover. With the Murphy bed down, he had even less. He finally stopped in front of the window, staring out.
I could force the issue. With the Sirius coming online, the G-forces of takeoff are going to be harsher than with the Jupiter. I could insist on physicals for all the astronauts.
He would see through that.
I'm not going to have him jeopardize the program or the people in it for the sake of his ego.
Or for mine, for that matter. Nathaniel didn't say it, but here we came to the problem. I didn't want anyone to know that I had anxiety. While some of that was fear that they wouldn't let me go into space, the rest of it was the same old concern. What would people think? And then beneath that, the fear that they were right. He's been deferring missions while he tried to figure out what was going on.
But now there's the moon.
The streetlights lit his hair into a corona.
You really think he's going to defer that?
I shook my head. I've been thinking about it all day. I'll have to get rid of the pills, that's for certain. And stop seeing the doctor. The more time between my last refill and when Parker outs me, the better. He will, though. Not immediately, because if he did, I would have no reason to keep silent. Nathaniel's head snapped back to me.
That seems like a very bad idea.
What else am I supposed to do? I spread my hands, but my fingers were shaking, so I rested them in my lap again. He knows. I don't know how, but he does. With a grunt, Nathaniel turned to pace again.
The driver. That night we stayed in a hotel because of the reporters. I sent a driver to pick up our clothes and your prescription.
So it wasn't just Parker who knew. How long? How long before everyone knew and I got booted from the program and it went into the papers and... My stomach lurched and twisted in time with my thoughts. I staggered to my feet and barely made it to the bathroom before losing it. Huddled on the bathroom tiles, I clutched the toilet and retched. Nathaniel came in behind me and held my shoulders as all of the accumulated anxiety of the day heaved out of me, and I hated myself. Daddy would have been so disappointed in me, unable to handle a little pressure. If I couldn't handle this, maybe I shouldn't be in the space program. I was stupid and weak, and it didn't matter how hard I worked. The sickness would always be a part of me. Nathaniel filled the tumbler from the bathroom sink with water and held it out to me.
I won't let anyone hurt you.
How will you stop him? My throat hurt as I spoke, but I took the water and swallowed.
I don't know.
He ran a hand over my hair and down my back.
Not all of it, at any rate.
I don't even know part of it. I rocked back to sit on the floor, leaning against the side of the tub. Nathaniel stood and opened the medicine cabinet. No. My fingers tightened around the tumbler. Ignoring me, Nathaniel pulled out the bottle of Milltown and crouched in front of me.
Elma, is this better? Throwing up and being miserable? Is that better than whatever it is Parker could do to you?
I don't... My voice fractured on the pain in my throat. I don't know.
Then let me tell you what I see.
Nathaniel shifted to squeeze in next to me against the tub. He put an arm around my shoulders and pulled me against him, the pill bottle in one hand. Okay.
You're better. With this. I was so... so worried about you before.
He shook the bottle so the pills rattled inside it.
Before this. I could hear when you threw up. You'd stopped eating. We went to bed together, but you didn't sleep. And you weren't talking to me about any of it. I thought you might be pregnant until that day in my office. I was really frightened for you. And right now, the idea that Parker might put you through that deliberately because he's made you afraid to use a tool that helps. I would like to punch him.
That last sentence was so matter-of-fact that a laugh surprised its way out of me. Wiping my eyes with the back of my hand, I looked up at Nathaniel, but his eyes were squeezed shut, a crease carved between his brows. You aren't kidding. He let his breath out in a controlled stream.
No.
Rolling the bottle in his fingers, he shook his head.
I have never had such a strong urge for violence. If I had been there, I probably would have punched him, and then he would have beaten the tar out of me.
With each revolution of the bottle, the little white pills inside rattled and shifted. Their tiny clatter promised a blanket of soothing calm. I don't know what to do.
Do you think the pressure is going to get any lighter?
Sighing, I folded in on myself and sagged against Nathaniel. He pulled me tight, pressing his lips against the top of my head.
Here's what I think. You keep yourself healthy, and then we can deal with Parker. Together. I don't know how, but I know we can.
How can you be so sure?
Because we survived the end of the world.
He kissed me again.
And you are my lady astronaut.
I followed Nicole's maid back to her sunken living room, where most of the 99s were munching on hors d'oeuvres and sipping cocktails. Jasira and Sabia had joined the mix, but I didn't see Betty or Violette. Sorry I'm late, Aunt Esther called, and it took a while to get off the phone.
How is the dear?
Nicole rose from the arm of the sofa she was perched on, leaving Imogene with her head bowed over a flight manual.
Martini?
Please. The glory of knowing a senator's wife was that liquor was never lacking at the Wargan House. I'd taken the Milltown out of my purse, but hadn't gotten rid of it, and having something to take the edge off seemed very appealing. Helen bounded across the room to hug me, still holding the manual she'd been studying. Missed you. Me too. Maybe we can grab dinner sometime? I'd gone past the computer department a couple of times after my promotion, as they called it, but it had been awkward. I kept wanting to check numbers, but that would just annoy everyone. What are you reading? She shrugged. It's just orbital trajectory calculations. Pretty basic.
Basic for you?
Nicole handed me a martini with a laugh.
Some of us struggle with that stuff.
That's why we trade. You teach me about simulator, I teach you about orbital calculations.
I raised my glass. And if someone can get the acronyms through my head, I would be greatly appreciative. The clear, cold gin lit up my mouth with all its juniper glory. I closed my eyes and sighed with appreciation as my shoulders relaxed just a smidge. I'd missed these women. Thank God Nicole had thought about setting up a study group. Opening my eyes, I carried my cocktail and my books over to join Helen on the sofa. Kicking off my shoes, I settled down and tucked my feet up under me. No Pearl? Helen shook her head and scowled.
She doesn't think there's any point in prepping for the astronaut tests.
They have to open it up more widely at some point, if it's really going to be a colonization effort. From her spot on the sofa, Nicole nodded.
And that's something my husband strongly supports.
Wait. I blinked, feeling like I'd missed something. Are they still talking about keeping it a military venture? With a sigh, Nicole scooted forward to face me.
I know you hate the idea, but...
But nothing. We have to get off the planet. I mean, sure, they might, and I stress the word might, be able to keep the greenhouse effect from running away, but by the time we know if that's going to work, it'll be too late to try to establish colonies elsewhere. We have to do it now, while we have the resources and the time.
Preaching to the choir.
Nicole smoothed the pages of her book, then reached for her martini. She took a sip of it before she continued. All of us, it wasn't just me, were staring at her, waiting to see what she was going to say.
But there are members of Congress, and in fact of the UN, who only respond to questions of military threat. So if having a military component to the missions is useful in getting funding and keeping the program going, then that's what my husband will do.
That's... Why are people so stupid? Nicole shrugged and unbuttoned her blouse by one.
Hormones. And if men are going to be led by them, then I'm happy to play my part.
Ida raised her glass. Here, here.
How are you ladies doing this evening?
Poor Senator Wargan chose that moment to wander into the living room. I'm pretty sure he wasn't used to a room full of women laughing at him, but he didn't seem to mind.
Does anyone know what an M-I-T-T-S is?
Jasira looked up from the binders she had been studying. She'd stretched out on the floor with her legs kicked up behind her. That was all I could offer.
Mobile Igor Tracking Telescope System,
Ida said, without even looking up from the book she had open. She tapped the pencil against the edge of the page as she read.
Seriously? An acronym within an acronym?
I tilted my head back to glare at the ceiling. I'm trying to remember what Igor means.
Intercept Ground Optical Recorder.
Why the hell wasn't she in the astronaut corps already? I mean, besides the color of her skin.
You should be in the program.
Ida snorted, but didn't look up. Her pencil beat a faster rhythm on the pages.
The application rules are such obvious baloney. If they could bend them for Violette and Betty, then...
Elma? Nicole shook her head.
Come on.
All the frustration of the past months rolled out of me.
Violette barely had 100 solo flight hours when she applied.
Ida dropped her book.
You did not just say that.
Yeah. You want to give Dr. King some ammunition? You tell him to look into the flight records of Violette Lebourgeois and Betty Rawls.
Violette's in because she's French and her husband is one of the astronauts. Married couple in space makes a nice story, right?
Nicole closed her book.
You're not wrong, and you're not right either.
It's discrimination, pure and simple.
It was, too.
Betty's only in because they wanted to control the publicity, and life gave them a way to do so. Those two spots should have gone to the most qualified candidates.
You think I was the best candidate they saw? You think you were?
Nicole shook her head again, her eyes glittering.
I'm good. I qualified. But my husband is also a senator, and one who's been backing the IAC since day one. Jasira was a beauty contest queen.
With a master's in engineering.
I didn't like where she was going with this. She was undercutting the very real qualifications these women had. And I didn't want her to get to me. From the floor, Jasira pushed up to sit and crossed her legs in front of her.
Yes, but I was not the only Brazilian woman with a pilot's license and an engineering degree. Granted, there are only four of us, but I was not the one with the most flight time.
And I was Mr. Wizard's lady astronaut.
It's all about the story that the IAC wants to tell.
Nicole shrugged and took a sip of her martini.
That's what politics is. Stories.
And the story that they want to tell doesn't include black people? I winced, realizing I'd cut Helen out of the equation. Or Taiwanese? Just white people? Ida shrugged and closed her book with a thump.
Same old story, just another chapter.
She stood up and stretched.
I better call it a night.
A chorus of yawns and agreements met her, and the party broke up. As I put on my hat and pulled on my gloves, I kept wanting to rant about the unfairness of it. But I didn't. Ida had made it pretty clear that she was done with the topic. And then there was the other nagging thought. The thing is, I don't know how much of my anger was a desire to help the black cause, and how much was because I wanted to get Violette and Betty out of my way.
36. Dr. King charges IAC with discrimination, special to the National Times. Kansas City, Kansas, November 22nd, 1957. Amid allegations that two of the so-called lady astronauts were not qualified for the program, a Southern Negro minister has charged the International Aerospace Coalition with discrimination. The United Nations Governing Committee has convened a special hearing to discuss the truth of the charges. Director Norman Clemmons has stated that the two women were part of a pilot program to see if mission specialists could be trained for the space program without the rigid requirements of the early astronauts, something that would be necessary, he said, for the establishment of colonies.
The Mastiff is at once a joy and a bane, and not just because it's another acronym. The Multi-Axis Space Test Inertia Facility, or Gimbal Rig, is a giant thing that a mad scientist designed. I might even mean that literally. Certainly it would look at home as a torture device in some underground lair. At the moment, Nicole was strapped into the chair at the heart of it. The rigid plastic chair was a replica of the Artemis astronaut couches, except that her head was strapped in a fixed position. Surrounding the chair were aluminum tubes that formed a three-axis gimbal rig. I say aluminum tubes, but they were really more like cages. Each one could move independently of the others, tumbling the chair over on the roll, pitch, and yaw axes. Right now, Nicole was rotating at a leisurely 15 RPM, but the thing could get up to 30 RPM. In theory, it gave us a sense of the sort of tumbling that might happen during a space mission, although if anyone were ever tumbling at 30 RPM, something would have gone terribly, terribly wrong. I leaned against the wall of the control room, waiting with Jasira and Betty for our turn. An actual scientist ran the test, but our evaluation was done by one of the other astronauts, which is why Parker stood at the observation window with a stopwatch in one hand. Betty stood next to Parker and tried to seem relaxed, but she had too much makeup on, which did nothing to mask the puffy bags under her eyes. I gathered from water cooler chatter that her testimony at the UN hearings about the discrimination charges had been rough. It was hard not to feel bad for her. A nitrogen gas jet hissed as Nicole tried to cancel out the rotation. It looked like she was going for pitch first. The jet popped and fired again. A whole series of cameras chattered along with it. I'd left the mill town at home because I couldn't risk having my reflexes slowed for this test. My stomach turned knots even before I got into the chair. At least they'd made the reporters stop using flashes in here, though I suppose you could argue that the strobing would be good practice for being disoriented in space. My right hand twitched, trying to anticipate the amount of gas and the timing Nicole would need to slow the pitch down. Jasira pulled her hair back from the nape of her neck. "Hey, boss, how much is this really like space?" Parker shrugged.
"Not much."
"So why do we have to do it?"
He shook his head and focused on the stopwatch and the window.
"Come on, Oregon. You got this."
Moments later, the pitch evened out, and Nicole started working on the roll. It was tricky because you still had to manage the pitch, but she'd been getting faster each time. The jets popped with fast little bursts of gas as Nicole stabilized the yaw. Parker nodded.
"Good. See how she's doing a double tap?"
I cocked my head, listening to the jets fire as much as watching them. "Is that better than a slow sustain?"
"When you're trying to gauge how much force it will take, yes."
He shifted his weight off his left leg and rolled his ankle a little.
"The trouble with the slow sustain is that it might not be enough to make a difference, and you can bleed off a lot of fuel without realizing it."
Outside, the jets popped twice more, then gave a sustained hiss as Nicole got rid of the yaw rotation. I watched Parker set his foot down and the way he shifted his weight as if he were testing it. Clearing my throat, I took a step closer to him. "Should we schedule some more T-38 time?" He almost looked away from the window, but arrested the movement and stared at Nicole, spinning around and around.
"Not necessary."
Since that trip to the clinic, he had only asked for one other side trip. We'd done other training, and I kept waiting for him to rat me out, but so far, he'd just been his usual condescending self, except when he taught. I almost liked him then.
"Why do we have to do it?"
Betty laid a hand on Parker's arm, a disturbingly intimate gesture.
"If the gimbal isn't like space."
"It's not, sweetheart. But it's more like it than most things you'll find on Earth."
He clicked the timer off.
"Good. York, suit up. Morgan's been in there enough times today."
My heart ratcheted up to a higher gear. I tried to tell myself that it was excitement. Well, I mean it was. I liked the gimbal rig. I just didn't like having to run the gauntlet of reporters to get there. Parker walked to the door and rested his hand on the technician's shoulder.
"Good job with her. Get the logs for me." "Yes, sir."
The tech straightened up as if just having Parker touch him had somehow revitalized him.
"Excuse me?"
Betty put her hands on her hips.
"This is our third time here and I haven't had a turn yet."
Parker barely cast a glance over his shoulder.
"I'm not being paid to waste time or the government's resources. You just keep being pretty and writing your little articles."
Just when you thought he wasn't so bad. I mean, I didn't disagree with him, but I wouldn't actually say that out loud. Wait. No. I had said things that bad about Betty before. That's why she had to testify to Congress. I sighed and turned to her. Her cheeks had gone red, and she had pulled out her reporter's notebook. You okay?
Of course.
She smiled brightly and jotted a note.
Just need to describe what one of these tests looks like. It's easier to do that as an observer, right?
Sure.
Better get going, or Parker will have your ass.
I headed to the door, grabbing my helmet from the bench. One of the technicians was helping Nicole out of the gimbal cage while Parker stood and talked with her. By his hand gestures, he was giving her some tips about the pitch correction she'd made. I think his patience as a teacher was part of what blindsided me every time we clashed. I very deliberately stopped in front of the reporters to put my helmet on. Much like the other astronaut skills I was practicing, I had been trying to desensitize myself to the reporters. Today, I focused on posing without seeming to pose. Who knew that astronauts had to do so much modeling?
Elma, what's been the most exciting task today?
It was always tempting to say something like, getting my nails done, except I knew that they'd print it. Today, I simmed terminal docking maneuvers and tried to fine-tune RHC inputs through an overly generous deadband. See, learning acronyms was useful for something. The cameras snapped and whirred as I strapped the helmet on. This was fine. They weren't a threat, and I knew what they wanted. Maybe that was the key to my anxiety in general. Figuring out what people wanted from me. Although if I kept that in mind, I would have gotten my flight suit tailored to show off my shape a little more, like I'm pretty sure Nicole had done. As she walked toward me from the gimbal rig, her waist nipped in just a little more than seemed possible in these boxy overalls. Parker followed her, smiling at the reporters. His limp didn't seem so bad today. Just a slight favoring of the left leg, and only if you were looking for it.
Colonel Parker, how are the ladies doing?
They're a credit to their nations.
He gave that shit-eating grin of his.
We're all very proud of them.
I headed for the gimbal rig, eager to see if I could drop my time from my last run.
Any truth to the rumor that you're being replaced on the moon landing?
The room went silent. Even the hum of the generators seemed to pause in mid-oscillation. Parker went pale, but his smile never faded.
I'd be curious to know your sources, but yes.
I hadn't told anyone anything. God, what had Nathaniel done? The room snapped back into motion. All of the reporters were shouting questions at Parker now. He held his hands up, and miraculously they responded by shushing.
I have a lingering war injury that needs some attention, so the agency and I decided that it would be better to attend to that.
He gave another smile.
I'm sure you understand that I can't make any speculation about who is going to replace me. Now, if you'll excuse me, we have some testing to do. York, get in the chair.
Parker walked away from all of us. Instead of heading back into the observation booth, he left the room entirely. I hadn't told. God damn it, I hadn't told anyone. But there wasn't a chance in hell that Parker would believe me. Smiling at the tech who stood by to strap me into the rig, I gave a little shrug. I need to run to the ladies' room. Back in a flash. I hurried across the lab and out the door that Parker had used. As the door swung open, I caught him straightening from the wall as if he'd been leaning against it, and only the sound of the door had brought him upright. He looked over his shoulder with an easy smile. It fell from his face when he saw me.
I told you to get in the chair.
I didn't tell anyone. Besides Nathaniel, of course. But he'd said he would tell me before he took any action. Parker's face stayed blank, but he looked at the floor.
I did.
I was still about 10 feet away from him, but that stopped me in my tracks, but...
I have bone spurs in my neck, likely from ejections during my test pilot days. They're pressing on my spinal column.
He shrugged as if that was somehow no big deal.
I know what you think of me. But believe it or not, I care more about the program than I do about my place in it. I would have been a danger.
What do you say to that? Are you going to be okay?
Surgery. Tomorrow, actually.
Is there anything I can do?
Yeah. Get in the fucking chair like I told you to.
He raised his head and took a step closer.
And don't insult either of us by pretending you care.
Wow. You really do practice being offensive. The side of Parker's mouth curled.
Go. When I come back, you damn well better have mastered that thing.
Yes, sir. For a moment there, he'd seemed human. I forgot who I was dealing with.
Just so we're clear, you still need to keep your head down and do as you're told. So long as you aren't a threat to the program, my lips remain sealed.
He took another step.
You earned that much. But the moment I think you're in danger, you're out. Are we clear?
Swallowing, I nodded. Ironically, I wished that I hadn't left the mill town at home. The rumor mill said that if Parker hadn't done the bone spur surgery, he'd risk paralyzation, which made the whole I care more about the program thing complete bunk. Of course, the rumor mill also said that aliens had implanted probes in him. The Monday morning staff meeting started with Clemens and his usual cloud of cigar smoke.
So, the first thing is to let you all know that Colonel Parker's come through his surgery just fine. No complications, and we should see him back here in a month or so.
I have to admit that my first thought was of intense relief that Parker would be gone for a month. That got me farther away from my last doctor's appointment, and maybe even if he told someone about the mill town, it wouldn't look like it was a problem. No one had to know that I still had pills which I was hoarding for an emergency.
What, he had already the surgery?
Le Bourgeois raised his brows in surprise.
I have only just heard that he was ill.
Clemens nodded, puffing on his cigar.
He'd set up the appointment some time ago, but didn't want anyone to know because he thought it would distract you. Good man.
I may have rolled my eyes at that version of history.
Who's going up instead?
Betty, ever the journalist, leaned forward across the table.
To the moon, I mean.
His shadow was Maloof, so he'll step forward.
Clemens pulled his agenda toward him.
That's jumping ahead on today's schedule a bit, but we'll need to pull Maloof from the next Luneta flight so we can concentrate on training for the lunar mission. Binkowski and Terrazas are already up on the station. All of this has made us realize that we need more manpower.
Manpower, of course. Why use any of the women who are qualified and sitting right here when you could bring some more men in?
Now, I want to be clear that this isn't a PR decision. It has nothing to do with the UN hearings. We'd always planned on expanding the program as things got settled, and Colonel Parker's injury just accelerated that timetable a little.
Sure it did. I glanced at Nicole, who had her mouth twisted in a little moo of displeasure.
It'll take a while to get them hired and up to speed, so I'll need your patience and help with that. Meanwhile, I think it's time to deploy one of the ladies.
Sabia scooted her chair forward and stared at Clemens intently. You could see the same thought bubble over her head as was no doubt appearing over all of ours. Me, let it be me. Please let it be me. I sat calmly with my hands folded on my lap, the way my mother had taught me. Beneath my shirt, my heart was leaping out and waving its metaphorical hands. Pick me, pick me!
Parker's suggestion, and I concur, is that we send up Jasira Paz Viveros.
He lowered his cigar.
Congratulations.
Finally. A woman was finally going in space. Normally, duty assignments were quiet professional affairs, but even the men were visibly thrilled for Jasira. I congratulated her, grinning so hard my face hurt. And I meant it, too. But I was feeling such a weird mix of emotions.
Jasira deserved the flight. I was thrilled for her that she was going to be the first woman in space.
I was relieved that it wasn't Betty or Violette, who clearly would have just been picked for publicity. Jasira was a real pilot. I was also weirdly relieved that it wasn't me, because as the first woman in space, she would be subjected to a level of scrutiny that would break me, especially without resorting to Milltown. But beneath all of those thoughts, I was afraid, because there was a part of my brain that wondered if Parker really had managed to ground me.
37.
Women Are Ready for Space by Robert Reinhold. Kansas City, Kansas, December 16th, 1957. Next week, if all goes as planned, a new milestone in space history will be reached when Jasira Paz Viveros is lofted into space for nearly 6 days to become the first woman there. The decision by the International Aerospace Coalition to send the 32-year-old beauty queen into space, along with two male crewmen, has been made despite long doubts and what some might call prejudices about the abilities of women to withstand the physical and psychological rigors of such an ordeal.
Sitting at the Capcom desk, I began to understand why Parker always had that damn tennis ball to throw. Mind you, I wasn't actually to Capcom yet. Cleary had that pleasure. I was just shadowing him while Binkowski and Maloof wrapped up their spacewalk. Cleary occupied himself by doodling and had filled a page with circles attached to circles attached to circles, and then a sudden jagged line.
Shit.
He sat up in his chair and turned the microphone on while simultaneously patching the capsule through to the loudspeakers.
What sort of problem?
Binkowski's voice crackled through the room, and the quiet murmur of idle conversation stopped.
We can't get the hatch closed.
Everyone started to move at once. Nathaniel grabbed his headset and the phone at the same time. I spun in my chair and reached for the library that spanned the shelves immediately behind the Capcom. The IAC had an entire volume dedicated to hatches and their closures.
Copy that. Describe the malfunction.
Cleary's voice gave no indication of the quiet energy that filled mission control. His job was to be the sole voice that the astronauts had to deal with while everyone else ran through all the possibilities.
It gets within 1 centimeter of closure and then stops. We've looked for obstructions, but nothing is obvious.
His breath echoed through mission control. I winced. The capsules didn't have airlocks, just a hatch on the side. For the spacewalks, both astronauts were in pressure suits. If they couldn't get the door closed, they couldn't repressurize, and they also couldn't re-enter the Earth's atmosphere.
Is it aligned correctly?
Yes. It is not an alignment issue.
Behind his voice was the steady hiss of oxygen flowing into his helmet. Nathaniel walked over carrying a schematic.
Tell him to open the hatch all the way. There's a stop that keeps it from swinging all the way open, but if he pulls it, then they can open it fully and get a better view.
Cleary nodded and repeated all of that to Binkowski.
Confirmed door release. Working on it now.
Through the speakers, we could hear his conversation with Maloof as they worked on the problem. Or rather, we could hear Maloof working on it. The capsule was so small that when suited, only one of them could be near the hatch at a time. While they worked, Nathaniel conferred with the mechanical team. At some point, Clemens came stalking into the room, still shrugging into his coat. He demanded a status report. I just tried to stay out of the way.
Kansas, we see the problem.
Maloof's voice broke through the chatter.
A loose washer is jammed in the seal near the hinge. We are attempting to pry it out.
Glad to hear it.
Cleary's shoulders relaxed a little. Mine too. The worst part was not knowing what the problem was. Now all we could do was wait while they dealt with it. Nathaniel leaned over the Capcom desk and asked Cleary, a little too casually,
Any word on how Colonel Parker is doing?
Very well. Although he has to wear the most amusing collar around his neck.
He grinned.
He does not find it amusing, of course. I think he called it the fun collar.
The fun collar? I looked at him. Really? I don't know if he blushed, but he suddenly became very interested in his circles again. Nathaniel exchanged a glance with me and mouthed, fun collar, with an accompanying masturbatory hand gesture. Clearing my throat was probably not the most subtle way of masking a laugh. Any idea when he'll be able to, launch again? I'm sure that's high on his mind.
Yes,
Nathaniel nodded, suppressing a smirk.
Launches are very important.
Thank God Cleary missed all of that.
I believe it will be another year for the bones to fuse together, though he will be back at work much sooner.
Too bad. A year free of Parker would have been a joy.
Kansas, we cannot get the washer out. The gloves are too bulky to grab it. Maloof wants to try to use a screwdriver to pry it out. Will this compromise the seal? Please advise.
My husband faded away and Dr. Nathaniel York snapped into focus.
How much oxygen do they have left?
Cleary frowned at him.
They are asking about the...
He shook his head.
What are your oxygen levels in the suits?
45 minutes, plus or minus 5.
Binkowski's voice had that disconcerting pilot calm, as if he weren't discussing possible death. Nathaniel rubbed his mouth.
Here's the call we have to make. If they rip the seal, they can't pressurize.
If they can't shut the door, they also can't pressurize.
Nathaniel turned to the computers.
Basira, what's the current state vector of the Luneta platform?
She grabbed a sheet of paper and rattled off all seven parts of the vector. 3 for position, 3 for velocity, and 1 for time. It was in a higher orbit than the spacecraft, which, thanks to orbital mechanics, meant it was going slower. They might be able to catch it. Clemens nodded, seeing where Nathaniel was going with that question.
Can they get to the space station before their air runs out?
In theory, maybe.
He called across the room again to the computers.
Basira, I need a trajectory and burn rates for a station rendezvous. Get the station's MC on the line. They may need to transfer to a lower orbit to meet them.
My legs itched with the urge to go to Basira and Myrtle's table, look at the numbers, and just do the math. But there were competent people there, and my job was here. To shadow. To sit and learn, and do nothing unless asked. Clemens said,
Here's my thinking. Can we have Binkowski pilot toward the station while Maloof continues to work on the hatch? If he gets it, well and good. If not, they're closer to the station.
Nathaniel shook his head.
If they fire the rockets with the hatch open, there's a high probability the kick will torque the hinge out of true. I think they'll either have to lash it open while Maloof works or just go for digging it out.
He glanced at Cleary.
Check me on any practical considerations since you've spent time in the capsule.
Cleary squinted, moving his hands as if he were trying things out.
Lashing it in those gloves. That's going to take some time.
Time. It would take them 10 minutes to dock at best, which only gave them half an hour to do the rendezvous. They have to do the burn now. Everyone stared at me as if a potted plant had spoken, except Nathaniel. His vivid blue eyes locked on mine like a tracking laser. Without turning from me, he raised his voice.
Basira, I need the state vectors on both craft, now.
She didn't blink, just grabbed the right page on the first go. Across from her, Myrtle circled numbers from the teletype and handed them to her. She was a good mathematician and methodical, but I was faster. I'm not sure where the pencil came from, but as Basira called out numbers, I jotted them down for reference across the page of Cleary's circles. While we worked, Nathaniel turned to Cleary.
Tell the crew to dig the washer out.
What about the seal?
Even if the capsule is leaking, that's going to give them a better shot at docking than having it wide open. At this point, we're assuming no re-entry.
Clemens nodded.
Tell them that we're sending up a burn attitude and targets, and they should maneuver as soon as they get them and load the targets.
There are times when numbers paint pictures in my head. They intersected with my pilot's brain, and I could see the arc of the ship and the controls in my hand. I double-checked my numbers anyway. Maloof and Binkowski had one chance.
Chances, we have the washer out. The seal did tear. 2 centimeters. Should we attempt to repressurize?
Back at his desk, Nathaniel said,
Negative. We may need to redirect oxygen to their suits.
The atmosphere in the firing room crackled with such intense focus. Somewhere in the support room, an engineering team was jumping into motion to figure out how to do that. And yet we all sounded as if we were discussing weather. Cleary might have been offering them lemonade.
Confirmed seal breach. Do not, repeat, do not attempt repressurization. We'll have the burn attitude and targets for you shortly.
Confirmed, Kansas. We'll stay in our suits.
Still writing, I glanced at the clock and my insides clenched. 12:32. This was so close. Expect a 43-second burn starting at 12:35. Someone cursed as they saw the margin snap into place. Final approach to Luneta station commences... 10 minutes, 10 minutes, after the burn. I lifted my pencil. Also, contact station and have them maneuver to docking attitude, perform attitude hold, and feather the arrays. If they didn't do that, the solar arrays would be in the way. Nathaniel took a step closer to me. He inhaled as if he were about to ask if I was sure, and then nodded. He looked at the clock. 12:33.
Do it.
Cleary looked to Clemens, who hesitated for a fraction of a second, and then nodded.
GC, give us a 10-minute countdown on the clock.
The ground controller set one of the mission clocks to count down from 10. While he did that, as matter-of-fact as a janitor, Cleary relayed my numbers to the capsule. From the calm of Cleary's voice, you'd think we'd just pulled this out of the library. We had hundreds of volumes of calculations for things that might go wrong en route to the moon. But needing to make a rendezvous in 40 minutes with a leaking hatch? Nothing we had took that into account. Binkowski responded with a calm to match Cleary's.
Copy, Kansas. Commencing burn.
The next half hour dragged and raced at the same time. It felt like forever. Listening to them and being able to do nothing except adjust numbers as they got closer. And then time would jump ahead, eating up the amount of oxygen they had left. At some point, I moved over to the computer's table and joined Myrtle and Basira in tracking the two spacecraft. Engineering managed to buy them 15 more minutes by having Binkowski bleed oxygen from one of the fuel cells, but it reduced the amount of power that they had available. If they took any more, none of the electrical systems in the capsule would work. The station came online.
We can see the shape of the vehicle now.
They were still miles away from the station. If they got the approach wrong, they could whiz past and lose time trying to correct.
0.7 miles out, closing at 31 feet per second.
This was all up to Binkowski now. He wasn't talking because the flight surgeon had instructed them to remain silent to conserve oxygen.
2,724 feet, 19.7 feet per second.
So close. Please let them be okay.
1,370, 9.8 feet per second.
Kansas, Lunetta, we're breaking.
Binkowski's voice had a wheeze to it. I traded a look with Cleary.
50 feet and holding steady.
In the control room, no one was breathing, as if we were all trying to conserve air for Binkowski and Maloof.
Kansas, we have them.
Around me, the room erupted in cheers and prayers while I slumped forward to rest my face on the desk. That had been terrifyingly close. And if it had happened at the moon, with no space station to retreat to, we would be listening to them dying right now. The moment we were through the apartment door, Nathaniel dropped his briefcase and kicked the door shut with his foot. His arms slid around my waist and pulled me back against him where his attention was quite apparent. His breath warmed my neck as he kissed it.
You are a miracle.
I'm a computer.
And a pilot.
He kissed a spot higher on my neck.
And an astronaut.
In training. Nathaniel nipped my neck. Hey! I laughed and turned in his arms to face him. The apartment was dark save for the street lamps shining through the window in a sodium glaze. Someone else would have realized the burn issue.
But not fast enough.
One hand came up to draw a line across my forehead. His fingers were cool and rough against my skin.
We've been damn lucky. And you, today, were part of that luck. By your convergence of experience and your extraordinary, captivating, exquisite mind. So let me call you a miracle.
I don't know. That sounds entirely too holy. I found the buckle of his belt. Nathaniel twisted his hips away and spun me so my back was against the wall. Running his hands down my sides, my husband sank to his knees in front of me.
Then let me worship you.
His hands ran up the inside of my legs, under my skirt until I gasped. Confirmed. Worship is go. A month after we heard about Parker's surgery, I walked into the Monday morning meeting and he was sitting there. A stiff neck brace held his head rigidly in place. He was thinner, and he'd been trimmed to begin with. He had shadows under his eyes, and I hadn't seen that even during the worst of the leg problems. But if you just looked at his demeanor, none of his troubles were apparent. Laughing, he leaned back in his chair, using the angle of it to look up at the folks surrounding him.
So I said that if they were trying to save weight, they'd have to get the astronauts to leave their purses at home.
The guys laughed. Nicole lifted her cup of coffee and said,
But if we did that, where would you keep your balls?
I loved her so much.
All right, people, let's get to work.
Clemens strode into the room, trailing smoke like a badly tuned engine.
Parker, good to have you back.
I grabbed a cup of coffee and settled into my seat next to Nicole. Leaning over, I whispered, "You are my hero."
You'd think it was a war wound, the way everyone is